Next matter on for oral argument this morning is State versus Douglas, State of Minnesota versus Douglas. Council, each of you is experienced, but I'll just remind you of our rules. For the record, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel for rebuttal. Please be mindful of those timing restrictions and state your name as you commence each leg of your argument. And just as a reminder, you can adjust the lectern to your height for your convenience. There's a button right in front. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court. My name is Todd Zettler. I represent appellant, the State of Minnesota. This is a state's pretrial appeal of the district court's suppression order, which ultimately resulted in the dismissal of count one. So in a state's pretrial appeal, the state must show critical impact. That's not really an issue in this case since count one has been dismissed. The state must also show that the district court clearly erred, and that is subject to de novo review on appeal. The exclusionary rule was adopted by the Minnesota Supreme Court, really, in State versus Lindquist, which is where the exclusionary rule first comes into effect in Minnesota. The exclusionary rule is a prudential doctrine created by the Supreme Court to compel respect for constitutional guarantees. The exclusionary rule is a judicially created remedy designed to safeguard Fourth Amendment rights generally through its deterrent effect rather than a personal right. Lindquist adopted one narrow exception to the exclusionary rule for binding appellate precedent. The exclusionary rule does not apply to violations of the Fourth Amendment when law enforcement acts in objectively reasonable reliance on binding appellate precedent. This search occurred in 2019. In 2019, the case law uniformly held that the odor of marijuana alone justified a motor vehicle search as probable cause. In 2023, Torgerson from the Minnesota Supreme Court changed that and found that the odor of marijuana alone no longer provided the sole basis for a lawful motor vehicle search.
Didn't they say they had never, the Supreme Court had never said it did?
That's correct. That's exactly what the Supreme Court said when it addressed, it first refused, the Supreme Court in Torgerson did not address the exclusionary rule and the Lindquist good faith exception. It simply ruled on its precedent and held that it was not a lawful basis.
Why didn't Ortega remove that, the notion that there's binding precedent supporting that the smell, I remember Ortega well, the Supreme Court modified our decision affirming, but on a different basis, clarifying that relying on Wicklund was, not effective because Wicklund was before minor levels of marijuana would be non-criminal. And Ortega says, Supreme Court says, no, the smell of burnt marijuana in and of itself does not give you probable cause to search.
So that's Torgerson from the Supreme Court. I'm not arguing that this court was right. I mean, what we're addressing here today is not whether this court was right previously and how it addressed the issue.
No, I'm talking about Ortega, not Torgerson. I'm talking about Ortega.
Right. However, in case after case after case after that, this court said odor of marijuana alone is a sufficient basis for a search.
What's your strongest support for that?
Really any of the cases cited in my brief, any of them. The law is uniform that the odor of marijuana is sufficient for a motor vehicle search. So for instance, this court.
Can we call it binding precedent if it disagrees with what the Supreme Court has held?
Yes, you can. And actually, you should look at Lindquist for what is binding precedent, because Lindquist defines it a little bit differently. Under Lindquist, The good faith exception adopted here applies only when law enforcement officers act pursuant to binding appellate precedent, not persuasive precedent from other jurisdictions. In addition, the binding precedent must specifically authorize the behavior, and law enforcement cannot extend the law to areas where no precedent exists or the law is unsettled. Under that definition, none of these cases from this court, none of these cases are precedent from other jurisdictions, and all of these cases approve motor vehicle searches based on the odor of marijuana. I found no case, published or unpublished, that found otherwise. The defense has found no case. I challenged them to come up with some, and they have not.
So you rely upon Thiel.
Thiel, Doran.
Thiel is not the smell of marijuana. It's the discovery of actual marijuana, isn't it?
Correct.
Doesn't that, so that can't be sufficient.
It's part of it. It's part of it because this court says so in case after case after case. This court says over and over that the odor of marijuana is sufficient.
No, but I mean Thiel.
Citing Thiel. This court, citing Thiel, says that. Okay. So the question is, was law enforcement off its rails in conducting searches and needs to be punished under the prudential doctrine? Was law enforcement in Minnesota not following this court's directive when they were conducting searches under the odor of marijuana?
Is there a precedential case citing Thiel for that proposition and applying it to the smell of marijuana as opposed to the discovery of marijuana?
No. Nope. The closest is Thiel, and then all of this court's unpublished opinions.
Right. So looking at the Supreme Court statement, it's got to be binding. It's got to be clear. Thiel is not enough. You're saying that this court's non-precedential representation of what Thiel stands for is enough.
This court's explicit statements, not summaries, but explicit statements.
Explicit statements and non-precedential opinions.
Yes.
Those aren't binding.
Well, they're not persuasive authority from other states, which is what Lindquist defined
binding. No, but they're also not binding.
They're not binding, well, correct, under the statute.
So aren't we left with just Thiel?
No. No, you are left with an entire body of law to decide whether or not this Minnesota law enforcement was following this court's directive or not. And when you have
the way Lindquist defines it, though, is it binding, clear statement. So you've got Thiel, which is, you've acknowledged, is not a binding, clear statement on this issue. You're saying the way this court has, in non-precedential opinions, interpreted Thiel, is what the officer can rely upon as binding.
Yes.
And what's the basis for that?
Lindquist and the purpose of the exclusionary rule. So in Lindquist, the Minnesota Supreme Court defined binding precedent as not persuasive precedent from other jurisdictions. We don't have that here. All of these cases are from Minnesota. All of these cases are from this court.
Well, the difficulty I have is you've got more than that. You've got Ortega, which says smell of marijuana is not enough. You've got Thiel that says discovery of marijuana is enough. And you have non-precedential opinions citing Thiel for a proposition that's inconsistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Ortega. Am I accurate or not accurate?
You are mostly accurate.
In which way am I not accurate?
You're not accurate in the sense that all of this court's case law holds that the odor of marijuana, burnt or unburnt, is sufficient probable cause to search a motor vehicle.
Okay, so just so the part that I'm in, so let me state it again and you tell me if I'm accurate. You've got Ortega saying the smell of marijuana in itself is not probable cause. You've got Thiel saying the discovery of marijuana is probable cause. And then you have a plethora of non-precedential opinions citing Thiel for the proposition that the smell of marijuana is enough for probable cause to search the car. Is that accurate?
That's mostly accurate, with the exception...
Which part's not?
Yep, add Doran, State versus Doran from this court, 654 Northwest 2nd, 137, also addressing the odor of marijuana. So...
How about the Pierce case, though? I know it's not marijuana, but it's language is pretty helpful to you, and it seems to rely on a number of non-precedential cases, and Pierce was relied on by a number of non-precedential cases that stood for that proposition.
Correct.
That it includes marijuana. Because, you know, the language in Pierce was, it has long been held that the detection of odors alone, which trained police officers can identify as being illicit, constitutes probable cause to search automobiles for further evidence of a crime.
Yes.
And that's the published opinion of this court.
It is.
Isn't Pierce distinguishable on the substance? I mean, in Pierce, you had a case of someone who was prohibited from having any alcohol. So any alcohol will be unlawful for this person. The officer smells alcohol. The officer then has probable cause to search the car for alcohol. That seems to fit Wicklund, which was back in a universe where any marijuana would be illegal. After Ortega, though, you've got this distinction because some marijuana is not enough. You have to have a criminal amount of marijuana, so the smell is not enough to establish that. So doesn't that distinguish Pierce?
I don't think so, because it's essentially the same argument. But
well, not quite, because how is it the same? Why isn't Pierce, as to alcohol, what Wicklund was to marijuana, which changed under Ortega? I mean, as for this particular driver, not all drivers, but for this driver, any alcohol, he's prohibited from having any alcohol. So we get to search the car to see if he's violated his probation or the law for him. Doesn't that distinguish Pierce from the marijuana cases?
I don't believe it does, because it goes to the same issue of what can you tell from the smell. And what you can tell from the smell, you can't tell from the smell of marijuana whether it's legal or illegal. And in 2019, that didn't matter. It matters today after Torgerson, but it didn't matter in 2019.
Right. Isn't that exactly what the whole Ortega... I mean, I think that's what I'm saying. I thought that's what I was saying, that there's a difference between a criminal level of marijuana and a non-criminal level of marijuana. But in Pierce, you had this unique circumstance where this particular individual, where no alcohol was allowed. All of it's illegal. So any smell would be evidence of a violation, where any smell of marijuana is not necessarily evidence of a violation and that there's actual quantity that's illegal.
In 2019, you didn't have to have proof beyond a reasonable doubt of an illegal substance. The odor was enough to give you probable cause to search. So the odor of marijuana was enough to give you probable cause to search for marijuana if it was in a motor vehicle. You could not...
It was a misdemeanor because it was in a motor vehicle rather than a petty, right?
Yes. And, I mean, as a practical matter, we would be ignoring this court's basically entire unpublished body of case law.
I recognize that.
Holding that.
Right.
And if you look at Linda Kugel, which isn't Linen Kugel, which is what I think of, but Linda Kugel cited in my reply brief, is a perfect case study of before and after Torgerson, because in Linden Kugel, this court followed the law. And in fact, the State Public Defender's Office conceded that odor alone is probable cause to search a motor vehicle. Torgerson comes down, and Linden Kugel is reversed. And this court says, yeah, we made a mistake with Torgerson, we misunderstood it. So the law was different in 2019, and that's what we're looking at. That's the only thing we're looking at. We're not arguing that this court was right. Clearly it was wrong. And the legislature, in fact, has now rushed to enshrine Torgerson in statute, and so has passed a statute saying the odor alone is no longer sufficient. So that's in effect starting when they signed it recently.
But your position is Ortega didn't actually already say that.
My position is that this court's case law, published, unpublished, precedential, non-precedential, consistently held through 2019 that odor alone was sufficient.
Well, you said precedential and non-precedential. You mean non-precedential?
Well, mostly.
What's the exception?
Peterson, Doran, Thiel, those cases taken in conjunction.
Well, Thiel, we already discussed Thiel. Thiel was a discovery. It wasn't about the smell alone. It was discovery of marijuana. And Pierce involves alcohol. So what's the published Court of Appeals opinion that's on all fours?
I don't have one.
Okay, fair enough.
But what I do have is this court's repeated case law holding that what the law enforcement did in this case was lawful. And law enforcement should not be punished for following what this court said was okay.
And you're referring to non-precedential opinions.
Yes. And not just one, not just two, and not just 1 year, not just over 2 years, since the 1970s. I see my time is up.
Thank you. You'll have some more time for the fun and festivities to continue.
Wait a minute. In the 1970s, we didn't exist. Only the Supreme Court did. So there's that.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Anders Erickson, and I represent Mr. Douglas this morning. We are asking that this court affirm the district court's order and reject the state's request to apply the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule. To start, I would like to make three quick points. First, it is presumed that the exclusionary rule applies unless the state meets its burden of establishing that there was binding precedent specifically authorizing the specific law enforcement's conduct. Indeed, under Lindquist, if there is no binding case law, or if the issue is undecided or unsettled, the good faith exception does not apply. Second, and simply put, there is not a single precedential opinion from this court or from the Minnesota Supreme Court specifically authorizing a warrantless search of a vehicle based only on the odor of marijuana.
Okay, so I think you're right about that. But the question is the officer's good faith. So don't the circumstances fit the spirit of Lindquist? You've got a binding decision by this court, which is interpreted by this court numerous times as stating something that goes beyond what that binding precedent says. So the officer has to decide what is my authority? Well, according to the Court of Appeals, in the Court of Appeals' abundant opportunities to interpret its own decision, has interpreted the decision to say that what I'm about to do is, in fact, something that I can do. I mean, at the very least, how would you say that the officer is acting in bad faith or in somehow, I mean, the exclusionary rule is supposed to punish officers or prevent officers from disregarding the law. This clearly isn't a disregard of the law, is it?
A couple responses. First, and I just want to confirm what your questions about Ortega. So in 2009, there was a footnote from the Minnesota Supreme Court that completely cuts against the state's argument. So I want to start with that. We did have binding Minnesota Supreme Court precedent in 2009. Second, I look at this not necessarily as the individual police officer's fault. The entire, whoever was training them, the executive branch, that's where it starts. So if they're relying on unprecedented cases that don't apply Ortega properly, that's the problem. So I'm not pointing at one individual who's committing misconduct by doing this. This court has the ability, when relying on precedential opinion like Ortega, to say, you need to change your training. I mean, that can't be the response to say, oh, we screwed up with our training, when they could screw up with their training all the time and say all sorts of things are legal. And the other side of this is for it to be, to fit within the good faith exception, it has to be within the published opinion. It is not our burden to prove that something is not lawful, right? So they can only rely on precedential opinions. So if there's non-precedential opinions, I don't even know why they're looking at those or relying on those. They should only be looking at precedential Supreme Court case law and precedential case law from this court. So if it's a non-precedential case, it wasn't, there was no review granted. I don't know if petitions were filed with the Supreme Court to review it because it was non-precedential. We just don't know what took place.
Well, I think the argument is that, yes, they're non-precedential, but they are persuasive in, to understand how this court is treating a binding decision.
I mean, we deal with unpublished decisions all the time, and that's not enough, right? We have a statute, and we decipher, we distinguish between non-published and published cases all the time, and everybody is aware of that, and we have, the legislature has articulated that in a statute. The United States Supreme Court in Davis and Lindquist could have said, you know, persuasive non-precedential opinions, but it didn't. It relied only on precedential opinions.
Mr. Erickson, so I'm looking at Doran, and it says, I'm reading a quote from page 142, the odor of burned marijuana inside a stopped motor vehicle provides probable cause for the search of the vehicle's occupants. So, I mean, Doran is from 2002. It's not been overruled as far as I know. Isn't that binding appellate precedent?
For two reasons. No, one, it's pre-Ortega, and two, it's search of the occupants.
Well, what makes it not binding?
Well, it's binding in the sense that it was binding in 2002 for the search of occupants, not for the vehicle. That's the distinguishing factor in Doran. So it's nowhere in that opinion does it say you can search a vehicle. It's the occupants of the vehicle. Second, it is relying on Wicklund, which, as we've discussed, was overruled, and it was made clear in Ortega that that's not binding law. So, you know, I'm not a prosecutor training police officers, but if I were, I would have to look at case law, the opinion, okay, and then understand that Ortega specifically said don't rely on Wicklund, and also this wasn't a search of an occupant. This, you know, what Torgerson stands for is a search of the vehicle, which is a different analysis.
So, I mean, the fact that Doran could be called into question, the fact that Doran, and I'll put Pierce in that category too, which had to do with odors, not marijuana, but alcohol. But the fact that they could be called into question because of the cases that they relied on, but they never were questioned. I mean, is there any opinion of this court or the Supreme Court after Doran and Pierce that looks back at those opinions and says those were wrong?
Well, no one relies on Doran or Pierce because we rely on Ortega. And Ortega was 7 years after Doran. And I don't...
Doran and Pierce were relied upon, at least in non-precedential opinions. But they were, I mean, they were binding appellate precedent when issued. You agree with that?
Correct, for occupants.
And they've never been overruled.
Yeah, they have been overruled by Ortega.
Never been expressly overruled.
So
you're saying they've been implicitly overruled?
I don't think the Minnesota Supreme Court goes through every one of this court's decisions and lists them off and says this one's overruled, this one's overruled. Because it wasn't relevant in Ortega because it was a court of appeals decision. I mean, Ortega clearly stated that the smell of marijuana alone does not create probable cause, period, in footnote 2, and overruled. It didn't change the decision, as Judge Ross was mentioning. But the other thing, again, it's the occupant and not the vehicle. We need a clear express, the good faith exception to apply under Davis and Lindquist, we have to have a clear statement by the court authorizing the conduct. And there's nothing clear about that, especially when it's not binding now that we have Ortega. So if an officer had a situation where they smelled marijuana, got somebody out of the car and searched the person and relied on Doran, that would be a different question, I suppose. But because of Ortega, it's not good law anymore.
When Lindquist talks about case law specifically allowing, I guess, how specific does it have to be? Must it be a case about marijuana versus alcohol?
Given our case law, yes.
I mean, didn't Torgerson kind of mix and match prior opinions about alcohol and marijuana when talking about the case law going forward?
It did. It distinguished it from Schinzing, which is a 1983 case, and Burbach, which is a 2005 case, and those are both alcohol cases. So it mentioned it, but then made clear that the Minnesota Supreme Court has never held that the smell of alcohol or marijuana alone allows for a search without a warrant. So they did discuss that in Torgerson. But again, as Judge Rosh was discussing, we're talking about marijuana, and there's a different you know, under Pearson, that was a crime on its own. After Ortega, we know that this, just the smell of marijuana alone does not indicate that there's been a crime committed.
So if we were, let's imagine we were here, in this case, before Torgerson. So we were looking at Pierce, Doran, and other cases. I mean, the manner of our analysis of applying the, you know, those cases to the current situation, is that different from, or is it the same as the way we determine under the good faith exception whether binding appellate precedent exists?
Sorry, can you repeat?
Well, yeah, I think, and let me, I'll just make a statement. Maybe,
yeah, make a statement.
I think you, and perhaps Judge Ross also, take the view that if we're considering a Fourth Amendment issue in a straightforward way and people are giving us case law, we look at that case law and decide whether it applies, whether it supports this search or not. And we might look at, you know, whether it's well-reasoned, whether it relies, whether the cases cited are cases that still have vitality or whether they've been limited or narrowed. I mean, I think Wicklund, maybe not overruled, but narrowed by Ortega. But I think when we're applying the good faith exception under Lindquist and we're trying to identify whether there's binding appellate precedent on which a police officer could rely in good faith, I don't know if the analysis is the same or if it's quite as full-fledged or whether we distinguish. In other words, I don't think we read Doran and Pierce and try to figure out whether they were well-reasoned and whether their sources are still good law and whether their sources were well-reasoned and all of that. I think it's sufficient to look at those opinions and read the words they say and then ask ourselves, if an officer read that opinion, and we presume that they did, would they feel justified in doing a search based upon the smell of burnt marijuana? So I think that it's one thing to apply the precedent in a particular case and to be cautious or concerned about all of its nuances and whether the facts are similar or not similar, but when we're identifying rules of law that guide officers for the good faith exception, I think we to just read the language of the opinion. And, you know, if it states a black letter rule of law, an abstract rule of law, and if that rule of law can be read by an officer and then tells the officer, okay, now I understand, you know, what I can and can't do, I think it's different. Okay. So tell me why I'm wrong. And
I disagree. That's not the test articulated in Davis or by the Minnesota Supreme Court.
Can you elaborate?
Lindquist. Yes.
Let's elaborate about Davis. I am curious about... I'm guessing that there's, given the vast body of lower federal court law about Fourth Amendment, as well as other states, I mean, it probably this issue has been discussed and decided, maybe either explicitly or implicitly. But anyway, please tell me more about Davis.
A couple things. One, in Lindquist, the court made clear that it was only adopting a small part of the good faith exception, and whatever was articulated in Lindquist, that's the limit of Minnesota law. So I don't think we can
refer to Davis, right? Cited Davis, talked about binding appellate precedent. Didn't that come from Davis?
That's right. I'm just talking about as far as looking at other circuit courts and all of that kind of stuff. Our law, we have one case. It's called Lindquist, and now we're applying it. But as far as Davis goes,
assume for the moment that we are informed by Davis and its binding case law.
Yep. So under Davis, there is nothing more than you look to what the binding case law is. That's it. So is there a binding case that states X? If that exists and that gives the officer good faith to do the thing, then they can do it. But if that case doesn't exist, which it doesn't exist in Minnesota, there was no prior case, a precedential opinion stating that the smell of marijuana alone establishes probable cause, that's the end of the analysis.
Yes.
So it sounds like you might
have just agreed with part of what I said. Part of what I said is that an officer can rely upon, say, an abstract statement of law that appears in the opinion.
I disagree with that.
Oh, okay. I thought you were agreeing with that.
No. So it has to be a clear rule of law that a binding court or in a binding opinion that they can rely on. It can't be that opinion was 20 years ago and it's been overruled multiple times and then misinterpreted in an unpublished decision. That's not how it works. It is the case that is being relied on, so in this case Torgerson, that has to have overruled some other case that was being relied on by the officers. And that's what was discussed in Davis in the inventory search. There was a specific case on point that gave the officer the good faith to do the thing, and then Davis overruled that case, expressly overruled it. We don't have that here. Torgerson didn't overrule any case. It clarified that it had never held that the odor of marijuana alone creates probable cause.
Okay, now I feel like, again, what you just said cuts against your argument. The fact that we have Court of Appeals case law that's never been overruled.
We don't have any Court of Appeals case law that states that the smell of marijuana allows for a search of a vehicle, period.
Okay, so you're in your view, the level of specificity, it has to be all of the, in, for this kind of a search, it has to be about marijuana, not alcohol, search of a vehicle, not occupants.
Yeah, because those are completely different analysis.
Actually, we do have a Court of Appeals decision saying that the smell of marijuana alone is sufficient to search a vehicle, and it was Ortega.
Right, which was overruled in the same case by the Minnesota Supreme Court. So I don't know how much clearer the Supreme Court needs to be. And even though there were non-presidential opinions, again, there were other factors in those cases going on. If this court wanted to publish one of those cases, I'm pretty sure the Minnesota Supreme Court would have granted review after Ortega and done, you know, and clarified that it was wrong and it shouldn't have been because of prior case law, not because it was relying on precedent. And I just want to get to one more thing as part of your question. As far as the deterrent for law enforcement behavior, that is what it is trying to remedy. That's not part of the analysis. The analysis is only whether there was a binding precedential opinion that they were relying on. That's it. We're trying to get away or trying to stop bad conduct, and I think that goes layer by layer through law enforcement of how training is done, what they rely on during their training. It's not just on the field conduct. I see my time's up. If there aren't any other questions.
One more, if I may. Yeah. So, would you agree with me, perhaps again, maybe part of what I said earlier, in that if there were a precedential Court of Appeals opinion that said, you know, in literal terms, the odor of marijuana alone is sufficient to provide probable cause for the search of a vehicle under the automobile exception? It wouldn't matter what else appeared in the opinion. That quote, in other words, is sufficient to allow the officer to rely on that statement?
Post-Ortega?
Correct.
I really don't think we can play that hypothetical, because if there was a presidential opinion going against Ortega, post-Ortega, the Supreme Court would have granted review and said...
But if it didn't, if that Court of Appeals opinion, post-Ortega Court of Appeals opinion, is untouched.
Yeah, so let's say we had a 2009 Minnesota Supreme Court case called Ortega, and then in 2015 we had a Minnesota Court of Appeals case called Johnson.
Presidential
opinion. I would say that the law, as it comes to this court, you could say it's unsettled, at the very best. And unsettled law under Lindquist isn't, you can't rely on that for good faith.
And what if we take away that 2009 Ortega opinion? So we just have a 2015 Johnson opinion that says everything you think it ought to say in a single sentence, that you can put quotation marks at the beginning and the end and give it to a police officer. Is the officer justified in relying on that in good faith?
If Ortega doesn't exist and there's a published Court of Appeals case, yes. I believe that would be correct if we go down that road, I think. I hope I didn't just lose the case.
Wait a second, I think there's more.
Counsel, since your position seems to be in part, that because this is not a search of the person, it's a search of the vehicle, does any of that address the fact that this safe was pried open rather than being like a purse or something you could easily open?
The state has not raised any issue with the actual search. So we're not looking at how the search was conducted in this case. It is only whether the good faith exception applies. So the facts on the ground is what happened. It's not before this court. What we're at, it's only the legal question of whether the good faith exception applies to a warrantless search of a vehicle based only on the smell of marijuana. So I'd like to delve into hypotheticals, but that's just not before the court.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant.
So, respondent argues.
Again, just for the record, state your name. We know who you are.
Todd Zettler for the state again.
Thank you.
Respondent argues that from 2009, there's a published opinion, and it's so clear that all law enforcement should have been on notice, and it's completely unreasonable that they would ever conduct a search based on probable cause, odor of marijuana. That fails to explain why the state public defender's office routinely conceded it, why this court routinely got it wrong thereafter, and why it has never been cited by any case. So when this court rules one way, when there's published cases ruling the same way, and when law enforcement relies on what this court says, law enforcement shouldn't be punished for following this law.
Can I see if I can squeeze a little concession out of you, just a little one? Your brief says, binding precedent from the Court of Appeals held that the odor of marijuana alone justifies a vehicle search, citing Thiel. That's not quite accurate, is it?
Correct.
Thank you.
Final thing I'll say is probable cause is probable cause. What you can do with probable cause might be different, but there aren't different standards of probable cause. So with that, I would ask this court to reverse the district court and remand.
Mr. Zettler, do you agree with Mr. Erickson about sort of the level of specificity required by the good faith exception?
No, I do not. Based on what Lindquist says. When you read Lindquist, it is fairly broad. I mean, it's a narrow exception, the binding appellate precedent, but it's otherwise fairly broad and discusses how the good faith exception should only be applied when there is a purpose to it such that it actually punishes law enforcement, and there's a reason to punish law enforcement because they are misbehaving by not following this court's orders. That's not happening here. That's not the state of the law in 2019. That was not the state of law enforcement in 2019.
Unless you treat Ortega as binding authority on the issue.
Unless you looked at the footnote in Ortega that this court missed entirely and that the state public defender's office never cited, this court never relied on, and this court ruled contrary to that time after time after time.
So just a quote from the Supreme Court, we take this opportunity to clarify that the odor of burnt marijuana justified the warrantless search in Wicklund because, and it explains why, we also note that although probable cause to arrest satisfies, et cetera, the court goes on to say it rejects this court's decision that probable cause to search the vehicle results from the smell of marijuana. I mean, that was expressly rejected by the Ortega court.
Yes. I think that's the holding in that case.
But because this court in unpublished opinions overlook that, I hate to say this, but, you know, when we're in law school, we're always told, you know, bad facts make bad law. I've come to feel that mediocre or incomplete lawyering kind of makes bad law because sometimes the court is not apprised of precedent. I'm wondering whether if any of these cases where our court in unpublished opinions relied upon Thiel for the proposition that is inconsistent with Ortega, anyone ever raised the Ortega to this court? Whether this court, I don't think in any of these unpublished opinions our court said, oh yeah, we've got Ortega, but that's not really the law.
I'm unaware of anything like that.
I remember Judge Kyle in federal court always said, don't put anything in a footnote. Nobody reads them, so maybe that's the lesson.
There's a lot of footnotes here.
Well, thank you both. Unless there's any further questions from the panel, I believe we've had as much enjoyment as we can from this very interesting case. Thank you for your arguments, both of you. Well done, both written and oral. The matter is submitted. We'll issue our opinion within the statutory period. This is the last case on our oral calendar today, so we are. Thank you.
Thank you.